content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. For our first article today, it's "We Are Entering an AI Price-Fixing Dystopia." Algorithmic collusion appears to be spreading to more and more industries, and existing laws may not be equipped to stop it. This was written by Roge Karma. If you rent your home, there's a good chance your landlord uses RealPage to set your monthly payment. The company describes itself as merely helping landlords set the most profitable price, but a series of lawsuits says it's something else, an AI-enabled price-fixing conspiracy. The classic image of price-fixing involves the executives of rival companies gathering behind closed doors and secretly agreeing to charge the same inflated price for whatever they're selling. This type of collusion is one of the gravest sins you can commit against a free market economy. The late Justice Antonin Scalia once called price-fixing the supreme evil of antitrust law. Agreeing to fix prices is punishable with up to 10 years in prison and a $100 million fine. But as the RealPage example suggests, technology may offer a workaround. Instead of getting together with your rivals and agreeing not to compete on price, you can all independently rely on a third party to set your prices for you. Property owners feed RealPage's property management software their data, including unit prices and vacancy rates, and the algorithm, which also knows what competitors are charging, spits out a rent recommendation. If enough landlords use it, the result could look the same as traditional price-fixing cartel. Lockstep price increases instead of price competition. No secret handshake or clandestine meeting needed. Without price competition, businesses lose their incentive to innovate and lower costs, and consumers get stuck with high prices and no alternatives. Algorithmic price fixing appears to be spreading to more and more industries, and existing laws may not be equipped to stop it. In 2017, then Federal Trade Commission Chair Maureen Olhausen gave a speech to antitrust lawyers warning about the rise of algorithmic collusion. Is it okay for a guy named Bob to collect confidential price strategy information from all the participants in a market and then tell everybody how they should price? She asked. If it isn't okay for a guy named Bob to do it, then it probably isn't okay for an algorithm to do it either. The many lawsuits against RealPage differ in their details, but all make the same central argument. RealPage is Bob. According to one estimate, in more than 40 housing markets across the United States, 30 to 60% of multifamily building units are priced using RealPage. The plaintiffs suing RealPage, including the Arizona and Washington, D.C. Attorneys General, argue that this has enabled a critical mass of landlords to raise rents in concert, making an existing housing affordability crisis even worse. In a statement, RealPage has responded that the share of landlords using its services is far lower, about 7% nationwide. RealPage's estimates include all rental properties, whereas the lawsuits focus on multifamily building units. According to the lawsuits, RealPage's clients act more like collaborators than competitors. Landlords hand over highly confidential information to RealPage, and many of them recruit their rivals to use the service. Those kinds of behaviors raise a big red flag, Maurice Stuckey, a law professor at the University of Tennessee and a former antitrust attorney of the Department of Defense, told me. When companies are operating in a highly competitive market, he said, they typically go to great lengths to protect any sensitive information that could give their rivals an edge. The lawsuits also argue that RealPage pressures landlords to comply with its pricing suggestions, something that would make no sense if the company were merely being paid to offer individualized advice. In an interview with ProPublica, Jeffrey Roper, who helped develop one of RealPage's main software tools, acknowledged that one of the greatest threats to a landlord's profits is when nearby properties set prices too low. If you have idiots undervaluing, it costs the whole system, he said. RealPage thus makes it hard for customers to override its recommendations, according to the lawsuits, allegedly even requiring a written justification and explicit approval from RealPage staff. Former employees have said that failure to comply with the company's recommendations could result in clients being kicked off the service. This, to me, is the biggest giveaway, Lee Heppner, an antitrust lawyer at the American Economic Liberties Project, an anti-monopoly organization, told me. Enforced compliance is the hallmark feature of any cartel. The company disputes this description, claiming that it offers bespoke pricing recommendations and lacks any power to set prices. RealPage customers make their own pricing decisions, and acceptance rates of RealPage's pricing recommendations have been greatly exaggerated, the company says. In December, a Tennessee judge rejected RealPage's motion to have a class action lawsuit against it dismissed, allowing the case to go forward. It would be a mistake, however, to conclude from that example that the legal system has the algorithmic price-fixing problem under control. RealPage could still prevail at trial, and in any case it isn't alone. Its main competitor, Yardi, is involved in a similar lawsuit. One of RealPage's subsidiaries, a service called Rainmaker, faces multiple legal challenges for allegedly facilitating price fixing in the hotel industry. Yardi and Rainmaker deny any wrongdoing. Similar complaints have been brought against companies in industries as varied as health insurance, tire manufacturing, and meat processing, but winning these cases is proving difficult. The challenge is this: under existing antitrust law, showing that companies A and B used algorithm C to raise prices isn't enough. You need to show that there was some kind of agreement between companies A and B, and you need to allege some specific factual basis that that agreement existed before you can formally request evidence of it. This dynamic can place plaintiffs in a catch-22. Plausibly alleging the existence of a price-fixing agreement is hard to do without access to evidence like private emails, internal documents, or the algorithm itself. But they typically can't uncover those kinds of materials until they are given the legal power to request evidence in discovery. It's like trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, Richard Powers, a former deputy assistant attorney general in the Department of Justice Antitrust Division, told me. It makes the job really hard. In the case of RealPage, the plaintiffs were able to make the peg fit. But in May, a Nevada judge dismissed a similar case against a group of Las Vegas hotels who used Rainmaker, concluding that there wasn't enough evidence of a price-fixing agreement. Because the hotels involved hadn't shared confidential information with one another and weren't required to accept Rainmaker's recommendations, even if they allegedly did so about 90% of the time. The rulings so far have set the bar very high, Kenneth Rakowski, a litigation attorney at Holland & Knight, told me. The RealPage case was able to clear that bar, but it might prove to be the exception. And cases like RealPage and Rainmaker may be the easy ones. In a series of papers, Stuckey and his fellow antitrust scholar Ariel Azarek have outlined ways in which algorithms could fix prices that would be even more difficult to prevent or prosecute, including situations in which an algorithm learns to fix prices without its creators or users intending it to. Something similar could occur even if the companies use different third-party algorithms to set prices. They point to a recent study of German gas stations, which found that when one major player adopted a pricing algorithm, its margins didn't budge. But when two major players adopted different pricing algorithms, the margins for both increased by 38%. In situations like these, the algorithms themselves actually learn to collude with each other, Stuckey told me. That could make it possible to fix prices at a scale that we've never seen. None of the situations that Stuckey and Izraki describe involve an explicit agreement, making them almost impossible to prosecute under existing antitrust laws. Price fixing, in other words, has entered the algorithmic age, but the laws designed to prevent it have not kept up. Power said he believes existing antitrust laws cover algorithmic collusion, but he worried that he might be wrong. That's the thing that kept me up at night, he said about his tenure at the Department of Justice. The worry that all 100-plus years of case law on price fixing could be circumvented by technology. Earlier this year, a handful of Senate Democrats, led by Amy Klobuchar, introduced a bill that would update existing laws to automatically presume a price-fixing agreement whenever competitors share competitively sensitive information through a pricing algorithm to raise prices. That bill, like so much congressional legislation, is unlikely to become law anytime soon. Local governments might have to take the lead. Last week, San Francisco passed a first-of-its-kind ordinance banning both the sale and use of software which combines non-public competitor data to set, recommend, or advise on rents or occupancy levels. Whether other jurisdictions follow suit remains to be seen. In the meantime, more and more companies are figuring out ways to use algorithms to set prices. If these really do enable de facto price fixing and manage to escape legal scrutiny, the results could be a kind of pricing dystopia in which competition to create better products and lower prices would be replaced by coordination to keep high prices high and profits flowing. That would mean permanently higher costs for consumers, like an inflation nightmare that never ends. More profound, it would undermine the incentives that keep economies growing and living standards rising. The basic premise of free market capitalism is that prices are set through open competition, not by a central planner. That goes for algorithmic central planners, too. Next, Ukraine was biding its time, by Phillips Payson O'Brien. This week, reports began filtering in that Ukrainian forces had entered Russia's Kursk province in what many analysts assumed was a small cross-border raid, of a sort that Ukraine has attempted a few times since Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022. But as the hours and days ticked by and Ukrainian forces moved deeper and deeper into Russian territory, the seriousness of the military operation became obvious. The Ukrainians spread out as they went along and had soon seized more ground from Russia in a few days than Russia had taken during an offensive in the Kharkiv region that began in the spring. As part of the new incursion, Ukraine began deploying advanced armored vehicles, including German-supplied Marder infantry fighting vehicles, a striking development given the unease among Kiev's allies about being seen as escalating hostilities between the West and Russia. The initial success of what's looking more and more like a full offensive shows what Ukrainians can achieve if they have both the tools and the latitude to fight Russia. Ukraine's most generous benefactors, especially the United States and Germany, have previously expressed strong opposition to the use of their arms on Russian soil. In May, the U.S. made an exception, allowing Ukraine to use American equipment to hit back on Russian-based targets involved in the attack on Kharkiv. Still, the broader prohibition limited Kyiv's military options. Now Washington and Berlin may be softening their positions more than they're explicitly saying. A Pentagon spokesman said that if U.S. officials still don't support long-range attacks into Russia, but also that the Kursk incursion is consistent with our policy. Perhaps President Joe Biden, freed of electoral considerations, can focus more on how to best help the Ukrainians now and limit the damage Donald Trump could do to their cause if he wins in November. The The White House's notably bland statement on the Ukrainian offensive on Wednesday was hardly the sign of an administration in panic. Clearly, Kiev has been biding its time. Its planning for the current offensive took place quietly, and amid many pessimistic assessments of its military prospects by outside analysts and claims that it should save its forces for combat in the Donbas. The weakness of Russian defense is, in a sense, shocking, but it was also completely predictable of the way Ukraine has been asked to fight. Its allies' apprehension about taking the war into Russian territory has provided Vladimir Putin with a major asymmetrical advantage. The Russians have been able to send almost all their troops into Ukraine itself, safe in the knowledge that Ukraine's own partners were securing Russian territory from attack. Moscow simply took the U.S. and Germany too much at their word. Russian forces seem to have kept only substandard troops at the border, and the fortification in the Kursk area has so far presented few problems for the Ukrainians. The lack of Russian internal defenses first became obvious last summer when the former Putin confidant Yevgeny Prigozhin mutinied and directed an armed force to march towards Moscow, and apparently only small improvements have been made since. Between countries at war, there is no border, there is only the front, the Ukrainian analyst Mykola Belezikov told me. Russians have forgotten that, the Ukrainians did not. Andrei Zakharodnik, a former Ukrainian defense minister who now leads the Center for Defense Strategies, described five potential motivations for a new offensive: diverting Russian forces from other fronts, particularly near Kharkiv, discouraging further Russian cross-border attacks into Ukraine by showing that Russia's own borders are unprotected, showing the rest of the world that despite its size, the Russian army is weaker than it appears, testing out new military tactics, and taking initiative away from the Russian side. The larger question is how far the Ukrainians want to expand their current offensive. Throughout this war, widespread electronic surveillance by both sides has frequently tipped each off about the other's plans. But in recent weeks, Kyiv built up the necessary forces so stealthily that Russians had no idea what was going to hit them. The Ukrainians apparently carefully arranged for drones and computer hackers to suppress Russian resistance once their soldiers crossed the border. In 3 days, they came close to seizing the Russian city of Sudza, through which runs a key rail line close to the Ukrainian border. Notably, the U.S. and German governments have not publicly opposed any of this. Perhaps the two allies are no longer as nervous about cross-border operations as they were. Maybe the U.S. has finally come to understand that if Ukraine is really going to have a chance to win, it must be allowed to fight the war properly. The real answer, of course, is that no one outside the Ukrainian government really knows what is happening. And so far, Kyiv has been extremely tight-lipped on this operation. Having kept it quiet before it started, the last thing the Ukrainians want to do is let Russia know their intention. Whatever happens, the Kursk offensive has been a well-executed operation to this point. It's their plan. Let them see to it. Today's third article is What Democrats Can Learn from the Trauma of 1968 by George Packer. The Democratic Party will gather in Chicago this month like a trauma victim irresistibly drawn back to the original scene of horror, returning decades after the 1968 convention to overcome its spell or else succumb to it. Let's first consider the ways that the Democratic Convention of 2024 is nothing like that of 1968. In June of that year, the murder of Senator Robert F. Kennedy took away the party's best chance of victory in November and killed the last hopes of a generation of young people. Compared with the assassinations, riots, and other political violence of 1968, the bullet that clipped the top of Donald Trump's right ear last month was a security failure and a near catastrophe that history will likely place with other almost forgotten attempts on the lives of American leaders. The shot that nearly killed Trump was supposed to change him into a humbler, wiser man. At the end of Flannery O'Connor's short story, A Good Man is Hard to Find, the escaped convict says of the vain and garrulous grandmother who experiences a moment of grace just before he kills her, She would have been a good woman if someone there was there to shoot her every minute of her life. The better Trump didn't outlast his convention acceptance speech. In 1968, the single bloodiest year of the Vietnam War, 500,000 American troops were fighting in Southeast Asia. In 2024, Americans are not fighting and dying in Gaza, Ukraine, or any other foreign war. The hundreds of thousands of protesters against the conflict in Gaza remain smaller in numbers and political power than the anti-war demonstrators of the late 60s. The spring's campus upheavals were less disruptive. Vietnam tore the Democratic Party apart in 1968. When Senator Eugene McCarthy ran against President Lyndon B. Johnson in the New Hampshire primary in March, the president couldn't muster 50% of the vote, leading Kennedy to jump into the race, Johnson to withdraw, and Vice President Hubert Humphrey to take his place. This year's political crisis was not a stalemated war, but a declining brain. Old age was President Joe Biden's Vietnam, and the June debate his Tet Offensive. Once again, the credibility gap was fatal. If 1968 was a series of violent seizures ending with the Democratic Party exhausted, broken, but still alive, throughout the first half of 2024, the party was paralyzed, numbly waiting for a massive heart attack to kill it and the country. Then came Biden's withdrawal announcement in July, months later than Johnson's, and his endorsement of Vice President Kamala Harris. Humphrey, carrying the burden of the administration's war policy, was bitterly opposed in the run-up to Chicago, in the city's streets, and on the convention floor. This year's party's recovery from Biden's candidacy has been swift and dramatic. The winners in Chicago in 1968 were the party's enemies, the anti-war left and Richard Nixon. The convention probably cost the Democrats the presidency in two ways. One was the dissatisfaction of anti-war Democrats. Norman Mailer ends Miami and the Siege of Chicago, his narrative of the conventions, by announcing that he planned to stay home on Election Day or else cast his vote for Eldridge Cleaver, the Black Panther leader and candidate of the Peace and Freedom Party. The anti-war Democrats might have made the difference in electing Nixon, Todd Gitlin writes in his authoritative history, The 60s. Even more damaging, the scenes of chaos in Chicago turned many middle-of-the-road voters away from Humphrey. An academic study published 2 years later concluded that Democrats and independents who defected to Nixon because of their disapproval of the protesters appear to have cost Hubert Humphrey the election. His defeat was more consequential than anyone anticipated. 1968 was one of those years that turned the wheel of history. It ended an era, of liberal ascendancy and began a conservative reaction that continued for decades and in some ways never ceased. Perhaps the most important event of the 1968 convention, the one that most directly connects it to this year's, received almost no notice at the time. On the second night of August 27th, amid the bedlam of arguments over the platform's Vietnam plank, delegates approved a harmless-sounding proposal to set up a commission that would reform the process by which Democrats would choose delegates to nominate their presidential candidates going forward. The new commission ended the rule of the bosses and opened the selection of delegates to voters in state primaries and caucuses. No longer would a mayor like Chicago's Richard Daley control an entire state legislation. In the spirit of equal representation, the reforms also established quotas for black, female, and young delegates in proportion to their numbers in the party, placing identity at the core of Democratic politics. The changes put the party machinery in the hands of college-educated activists, more affluent and more progressive than their predecessors, moved by issues such as war, the environment, abortion, corruption, the rights of the marginalized. The reforms disempowered less educated Democrats more concerned with bread-and-butter issues. The bosses spoke for real voters, too. Politics is more cyclical than linear. The answer to a problem creates a new one. democratization leads to a different concentration of power, scoliosis, and the need for another transformation. The Democratic Party of 2024 suffers from two of the same weaknesses of this party of 1968, unaccountable elites and irresponsible rebels. The elites are no longer the big city mayors and state chairs and union chiefs. The elites of 2024 are the celebrity class of former presidents, top elected officials, extremely rich donors, and presidential family members. They are insular and self-interested. For much of the year, they've acted as if their loyalty to one another matters more than their duty to the party and its voters. Meanwhile, the great middle structure that allows party leaders to hear the voices of its rank and file has hollowed out. In this sense, Biden and Harris resemble Johnson and Humphrey, the candidates most ordinary Democrats didn't want, but the bosses imposed. It makes sense that instead of polarizing eruptions of 1968, we have the consolidated delusions of 2024. This year's rebels are pro-Palestinian demonstrators, third-party defectors, the young and the alienated. Whatever their political views, their disaffection is so great that many of them would welcome the defeat of the Democratic Party and could decide the outcome of in a few key states, such as Michigan. In 1968, the anti-war leader Tom Hayden declared that the candidate who would best serve his goals was George Wallace, the racist governor of Alabama, on the Leninist theory of the worse, the better. This year's revolutionary dreams lie on the right, with Trump hinting that he would end Democratic elections, and authoritarians such as Steve Bannon and the minds behind Project 2025 plotting to dismantle every structure of government that would check his power in a second term. The rebels on the left don't have fantasies of taking power. Their impulses are entirely negative, directed, as in 1968, not at the enemy, the Republicans, but at a near one. The clannishness of the elites and the alienation of the rebels reinforce each other. Both are signs of a political party that has lost its connection to the people who go door to door and make phone calls and serve as precinct captains and turn out the vote. Against most predictions, Harris's arrival seems to be galvanizing voters not because of her personal identity and establishment credentials, but in spite of them, because of the hunger for change. It would be a satisfying irony of history if Chicago once again becomes the scene of the party's transformation, this time with the nomination of a candidate who is so thoroughly a creature of the party's expectations that she is able to defy them. I'm sorry, but this last article was edited a bit due to time constraints. But we've already run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.